Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the latest research being done to help preserve and restore vision. And our guest knows a whole lot about that, Dr. David Gamm. He directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute at University of Wisconsin. Also, a professor in the Department of Ophthalmology and Visual Science. And his clinical practice is in pediatric ophthalmology. And his research interest focuses on stem cells and their applications to the study and treatment of human retinal diseases. So we'll talk about new research about glaucoma, optic nerve damage, and a whole lot more. And I hope you'll join in with your questions about eyesight and eye health. Love to hear from you. You can give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. David Gamm, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Well, maybe to start, tell us more about the McPherson Eye Research Institute. How does your research there help people and not just people who live in Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, so like many universities, we have a wonderful Department of Ophthalmology, and the mission for that department is to treat patients, educate the next generation of ophthalmologists, and also do research. But a huge university like the University of Wisconsin has people doing vision-related research in almost every department across the entire university. And bringing that all together, it can be a very difficult thing to do. So what we have that's unique at the University of Wisconsin-Madison is the McPherson Eye Research Institute, which is a research-devoted entity that doesn't look at boundaries and individual departments or schools and says, okay, what are you doing? Are you working to try to help folks who are facing blinding disorders? Are you doing that in the School of Engineering? Are you doing that in psychology to understand how we see and cognitive issues with regard to our vision? Are you doing that in ophthalmology, wherever it is? And then we bring them all together, and then we get them to work together, collaborate, use their individual expertise and resources, and focus that on helping the people with vision disorders here in Wisconsin and around the world.
Yeah, it's a great idea and a great institute. As we think about the causes of blindness or vision impairment, what are the most common causes?
Well, in terms of, there's treatable versus untreatable. Obviously, cataracts are extremely common. We all kind of face that as we get older, but imminently treatable. For the things that still plague us after, all these years of science, it's still, it's macular degenerative. It's degenerative diseases of the eye. And the eye is, at least the retina, is part of the brain, actually. So, if you go through a who's who of things we don't want to have because there aren't good treatments, there, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, degenerative diseases of the joints, of all of our different organs. So the eye undergoes degenerative diseases, too. And so it's when those building blocks of our tissues or organs deteriorate, we really have a difficult time putting them back together. And slowing that process down or reversing it once it happens remains kind of the brave new world of therapeutics that we're working on.
So is it age that causes most often vision loss?
Age certainly is a risk factor. The alternative isn't great either if you don't age. But it's not just that. There are genetic disorders. So there are a lot of things that we're born with that could either be injuries that we suffered as children or young adults, or just our genetic makeup that predisposes us to losing vision or having parts of our eye degenerate. So it's a combination of congenital or genetic disorders and acquired disorders, which tend to accumulate with age.
Yeah. Well, let's think about macular degeneration to begin. I know there's dry and there's wet.
So, everyone talks about that. So it's interesting because they think of it as two separate entities. So everyone who has macular degeneration basically has the dry form to start with. And you can think of that as kind of a slow smoldering degeneration of a particular layer within the back of the eye called the retinal pigment epithelium. And that retinal pigment epithelium separates the photoreceptors that detect light in the retina from the blood supply, the outer blood supply of the retina. And so as that degenerates, you have two things that happen. One is the overlying photoreceptors that detect light get sicker and sicker too, and that robs you of your central vision. But also that the barrier between the retina and those blood vessels also breaks down. So you can get abnormal blood vessels that grow into the retina, and then they leak or bleed. If that happens, then it's the wet form. Think of it like there's wetness there or swelling.
So can it happen to young people?
Not age-related macular degeneration. So age-related macular degeneration is an acquired disorder that has genetic components to it, but generally occurs in your 50s or older, and the prevalence of it goes up every decade thereafter. Mm-hmm. So if you make it to your 90s, congratulations, but also you've got a good percentage chance in the 20s, 30s, even 40% chances of having at least early stages of macular degeneration. Think of it like your parts wear out. If you live long enough, you know, our parts wear out. Younger people get other forms of macular degeneration, which are not the typical age-related form.
So I understand there are some new treatments for the age-related macular degeneration.
Yeah, they just, in 2023, I think a lot of us were inundated by the TV ads, too. I think Arthur Fonzarelli, for the folks that remember Happy Days, is one of the spokespeople for one of them. And it's promising, but also you got to take it with a grain of salt. So what a couple of different companies found was by modulating some proteins that are involved in the immune response in the back of the eye. And so that's kind of goes back to all the work that was done at, you know, what actually causes age-related macular degeneration. So a lot of research over decades kind of pointed towards the immune system having a potential role in that. And so folks started developing drugs that could target some of these pathways and hopefully slow it down. And a couple of them that focus on proteins called complement factors were shown to, if you follow the amount of degeneration over time, folks that got these injections, and they are injections that go directly into the eye every month or every 2 months, so they're not trivial in terms of going through the treatment. But they showed that it slowed that process down. So it doesn't reverse it. So it can't give you back anything that you've already lost. But if you look at folks that had it versus those that didn't, there was about a 20% or so decrease in the rate of the growth of that area of degeneration. Nobody got improved vision, however. So that's the thing to kind of...
But it didn't get worse.
Didn't get worse. Vision didn't get worse. For most patients, there are potential side effects. It was shown in some of the clinical trials that there's a chance to have some inflammation in the eye, which can be severe. So like any other experimental therapy, you kind of have to weigh, you know, what is it that I expect to get from this treatment? What's the cost? And what are the potential side effects? So it's promising, and I think it's an area that we'll see continue to grow and get better. But right now, it really requires a conversation between you and your retina specialist to determine whether it's right for you.
Is there much that you can do to prevent macular degeneration?
So the answer, I mean, back in the day, people would, we've known for a long time that lifestyle does have a role. And the thing that is probably the biggest risk factor is smoking.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, you know, now that we know that there's an immune component to the disease, it kind of smoking revs that up a little bit. So certainly stopping smoking is important. A healthy lifestyle, if you look at folks who just get, you know, what your grandma told you, regular exercise, eat well, work in antioxidants and a good healthy diet. This goes back to some of the vitamins that are often prescribed for folks or they're told to tell or told to take. Those counteract some of that inflammation as well too. So absolutely. But there is a genetic component too, so that some of us are just more predisposed to having it than others.
Bob in Verona couldn't stay with us, but this is a different issue. But he's starting to have double vision, and he wonders is this a potential sign of multiple sclerosis? And if so, what can be done about it? What treatments are available to restore his vision if you have double vision?
Well, we can spend the rest of the hour on double vision if you want to do that. I do that a lot. So really, it comes down to, like many things, if you say I have a headache, well, there's a thousand different ways, reasons you can have a headache. So double vision is the same way. And so one of the first questions we asked is it binocular or monocular double vision, which means is it true double vision will go away if you cover one eye or the other. So that means that your eyes are not aligned properly. And so if you're that category, there's a whole host of things that can cause that, and they do need to be worked up. On the other hand, if you say, well, it's in my right eye, and if I cover my left eye, I still see kind of two of things or even three of things, which is more kind of what we call ghosting as opposed to true double, then that suggests it's more of a refractive error, which or maybe a need to change your prescription in your glasses. So that's a much less serious thing, although it's still very annoying and needs to be addressed with. But true binocular double vision, where if you've never had it before and now you say, yes, I see two of things, and maybe they're side by side or they're up and down or they're diagonal or twisted, and I never had that before, and now when I cover one eye, it goes away, that's something that we want to work up, because that could be any number of things. It could be cranial nerve palsies. It could, you know, if you've had a recent injury, if you're being treated, it could be medications, all sorts of things.
So Bob and Verona probably ought to go in for a check.
You know, I hate to say it because that's what everybody says, right? But yeah, if it's new onset double vision, then getting it checked is important. Yeah.
Glaucoma, it's another leading cause of blindness, a condition that the Institute is researching, if I'm not mistaken. Symptoms of that?
So the thing about glaucoma is, and there are different types of glaucoma, but the typical one is called primary open-angle glaucoma, and it's a disease of aging again. And the problem with that is it's insidious, so you really don't know. Think of it like, you know, high blood pressure or high cholesterol. You know, it's one of those silent things where it can progress quite a ways without you having any knowledge of it. In its later forms, you lose peripheral vision and then ultimately central vision. And it's one of these degenerative diseases of the optic nerve that can't be reversed right now once it starts. So if you have high risk factors, if you have family history, or even as you get older, getting regular checkups is very important, because we can tell, just again, like checking your blood pressure, right?
Yeah.
When it's too late, it's too late. So getting on top of it earlier allows glaucoma specialists and your eye care professionals to institute relatively easy, you know, drops or changes in your medication to hopefully give you a lifetime of good vision.
Jan in Madison has a question that actually relates to glaucoma. So let's go there. Jan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having this program, Larry. I'm really interested because I have severe glaucoma and have been under the supervision of an ophthalmologist for a long time. About 20 years ago, I had surgery to reduce the pressure that was uncontrolled by drops. And now, over a number of years, I've had very low blood pressure. Pressure of 3 or 4. And the ophthalmologist has made the suggestion of having a revision of that surgery. But I wondered, what is the percentage of success if you have reconstruction of the bleb?
So, okay. So you mentioned a lot of words there. So, and I can tell you're a frequent flyer on the glaucoma end of things because you said the word bleb. So just to give a little bit of background for the listeners. So right now for glaucoma, one of the primary factors is high pressures in the eye, but it's not the only thing, but it happens to be the only thing that we can currently treat. So we try to keep the pressures as low as we can, but it's important for your eye to have pressure, just like a tire, right? If it's blown up too much, that's not good. But if it's flat, it's not good either. So you do have this kind of range that your doctor tries to find that's right for you. And so some folks you can tolerate higher, sometimes it's lower, but 4 is pretty low. And so what we do is we use drops that can act on the normal biological mechanisms in your eye that produce or drain fluid. And that's always the first step because it's the easiest thing to do. If those stop working, then there are surgeries that can help drain the fluid. And those do that in a controlled manner, but sometimes they overdrain or they stop working. And just like everything else, you know, if you have a replacement for your hip, you know, they tell you it's good for 20 years. And they follow you closely. And so in this particular case, that is a low pressure, and for long term with low pressures can have complications. So I do think, you know, your doctor is right to start talking about trying to do a revision. And they're quite successful. Not everything's 100% for sure, but this is not an uncommon situation that you're dealing with. And so there are very straightforward ways to deal with that. And so I would feel confident that your ophthalmologist will be able to handle that. Is it a glaucoma specialist or a general ophthalmologist?
Specialist.
Okay, gotcha. Because these more complicated situations generally go to the specialists. They're more suited to deal with them.
Jan, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We're taking a look at eye health today, the health of your eyes, with our guest, Dr. David Gamm. He directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're looking at the latest in eye health with our guest today, Dr. David Gamm, who is director of the McPherson Eye Research Institute at UW-Madison. Questions for Dr. Gamm, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Amy in Edgerton will give you a chance. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
What can we do
for
you?
Show. I'm a former high myope who had cataract surgery about 2 years ago. Since then, I am now seeing zigzag vision for straight lines and straight edges. It's a very odd phenomenon. I haven't gotten an explanation or a solution. Do you have any ideas?
Sure. So first of all, again, we have an educated audience here. So high myope, that means that's short for myopia, and that means nearsightedness. So folks who have a hard time seeing the distance, they're blurring the distance, but if they bring things close enough to their eye, they can see it just fine. The reason you have that is that you have a long eye. So farsighted patients have short eyes, nearsighted patients have long eyes. And because that eye is long, it stretches the retina and makes it thinner and predisposes folks to other problems. And usually high myopia is 6 diopters or more of a prescription. And it's a risk factor for retinal problems. Now, having cataract surgery, any type of surgery inside the eye, is an additional risk factor for retinal problems afterwards. I mean, you have to have it done if you can't see, and people are very careful and the procedures are much more safe, but it does increase that risk a tick. Some of the things that can happen with high myopia, with or without surgery having been performed, is something called metamorphopsia, and that's a fancy word for the zigzaggy lines or the kind of the slight distortion that you can see in the center portion of your vision. Usually it's one eye. It can be both eyes if you have a problem in both of the eyes. But what it does is it slightly, you know, pulls the retina, which is like the film in the camera, out of register with the other eye, and it kind of wrinkles it sometimes too. And if you think about it, it needs to be flat and smooth because the image that you're seeing is being projected onto this film. And if the film is a little wrinkly or a little distorted, then it's going to send a slightly wrinkled or distorted image back to your brain, which does all the visual processing. And that's not going to look the same as in the other eye. And so then your brain has a hard time kind of overlapping that. Now, sometimes that can be caused by something called an epiretinal membrane, and then that can be peeled off. So there are situations where you can do that. It can also come from fluid under the retina. So there are very straightforward diagnostic tests that can be done to determine whether that is. So like a lot of things, you want to, you know, you're very good at describing your symptoms, and an eye care professional should be able to go through kind of a list of what that could be, do the appropriate tests, and then determine what the etiology or cause is. And then the next step is, can we do anything about it? And sometimes there, yeah. You know, there isn't. Sometimes the treatment's worse than the cure, but more and more there are things that we can do. In the rare cases where it just, you know, there's enough going on there that we really can't fix, then we start talking about, if it's one eye, do we want to blur the vision in that eye so it's not doing double damage, wherein not only are you getting that distortion, but it's also affecting the vision in the good eye by overlaying that distortion on top of that in the visual field. So in those cases, we can say, well, you know what, let's just leave that as a backup eye and try to reduce its dominance in your field of view. So there's always something that we can do. It might not always be a great solution, but usually we can come up with something to make your life a little better.
Amy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Terry emailed. Terry's diagnosed with macular pucker. Mm. What can you tell Terry about progression and treatment for this?
All right. Well, that's actually one of the words for what I just described.
Yeah.
That the last caller may actually be experiencing is a pucker, that kind of wrinkling. So, you know, so And oftentimes that is after the vitreous or the gel in the eye pulls forward, or after surgery. High myopes, like I said before, get that as well too. They can progress if so. Oftentimes with macular pucker, that you have this jelly in your eye, and think of it like a pudding, and there's a pudding skin, and that pudding skin is attached to the retina. And so if that jelly detaches and leaves the pudding skin behind on the surface of the retina, it can start to wrinkle. And if it wrinkles and stretches, it can cause that distortion. And that can sometimes be peeled off, as I mentioned, and that can restore some vision, oftentimes not exactly to where you were beforehand. And there is some risk always in doing any type of a procedure or surgery. A retina specialist, if it's something that's been really something that you've been struggling with, the next step would go to be to see a retina specialist and to see what your options are.
You've been researching retinitis pigmentosa, if I'm not mistaken. What are the earliest symptoms of retinitis pigmentosa?
Yeah, so retinitis pigmentosa is a childhood onset or adolescent onset a host of genetic disorders. You know, over 200 different genes can cause it. And it's really one of the prime focuses of my research. It can affect newborns all the way up to teenagers. And one of the earliest signs is what's called nyctalopia, or difficulty seeing in dim lights, dim light situations. So it's the classic situation where you're walking into a dimly lit movie theater and everybody else, you know, can find their seat, but you're completely blind. You can't see anything. And so you're grabbing folks. And it's one of the signs that we tell parents and educators to be aware of, you know. So the child who, when they turn down the lights for the movie in the class, and they get really scared because they don't move their, get out of their seats because they don't know where they're going, they bump into things. That's a red flag. These are rare situations. About 1 in 4,000 folks have some form of retinitis pigmentosa. So most folks that have trouble seeing in the dark, you know, it's either age-related or something like that. But in rare occasions, it can be one of these genetic disorders.
And I would think that would be why regular eye exams are important for people with this.
Yes, yes. So, you know, if you have a diagnosed condition, you know, we have a regular schedule that we're seeing folks depending upon how quickly it progresses, what the treatment is. But even for folks that don't, like I mentioned, we mentioned glaucoma.
Yeah.
There are regular, you know, there are schedules that are recommended by, you know, the American Academy of Ophthalmology and the optometric associations, so that we stay on top of things and don't get surprised when the train's gotten too far down the tracks.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned this is a research area of interest for you. Could you talk a bit about the research going on?
So retinitis pigmentosa is one of these groups of degenerative diseases. So these are important genes that are expressed in the cells of the retina, usually the photoreceptors. And because these genes are not made correctly, they cause the photoreceptors to become dysfunctional and ultimately die. So they degenerate. And when that happens, you have this slow, inexorable loss of vision, first in the periphery, so the peripheral vision goes away, and then in the center. Sometimes it can be reversed depending upon the gene that's affected. But for eternity, there hasn't been anything that you can really do for that, because that progression of cell death, there is no way to stop it. There's no way to fix the genetic disorder that's underlying it. So you basically just try to maximize people's vision as they lose it. And that's changed. That's changed over the last 20 to 30 years, where we're now doing genetic medicine and we're doing stem cell-related medicine. I mean, it's still not as far as people would love it to be. And
sure,
there's as much snake oil out there, or more snake oil out there as there is legitimate research. But it's an entire field of medicine that wasn't present when I started 20-some-odd years ago. It was just fledgling. And now it shows real promise for folks to either slow down, or stop, or perhaps even restore some vision.
Jason in La Crosse has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, when I was very young, I was diagnosed with strabismus. So around 2 or 3, I had a surgery for it. They didn't think that I'd need a second one, but so I didn't, or my parents didn't. And growing up, I kind of noticed something wrong with my vision, ended up being double vision. So I dealt with that until about my 20s, and I had a second surgery. That was supposed to be a quick, simple surgery on the muscles of the eye to bring my eye backwards or back inwards. and that I guess there was a lot of scar tissue and they weren't able to do as much as they'd like. And now I'm going to be 40 this year and I still have double vision and my eye is noticeably, you know, out more than the other one. And I was just wondering if there's anything else that could be done. I tried prism glasses, stuff like that, and nothing has helped.
Okay. So the answer is yes. There's, you know, not knowing your particular case and situation, it's there's always could be extenuating circumstances that would come into play. But what you're describing, and you, as you did it, you did a great job as a historian, is that you had an early onset, what we call intermittent exotropia. So where the eye tends to wander out, and if you're really attentive to something or if something's really grabbing your attention, your eyes will be straight, and then at least when you're younger. But then when you're kind of daydreaming or looking off in the distance, the eye will wander out. It's very common, and it's one of the more common things that we see in pediatric ophthalmology clinics. And it's variable. So the eye will drift out and then be straight at times too. And what I tell folks is that there's no cure for that. You know, if you have an appendicitis and we take your appendix out, you're never getting appendicitis again.
Yeah.
But what we do is we try to reset the eye position such that it won't drift as much or it'll be easier to control. So one of the analogies I use is, and this is not, you know, actually physiologically correct, but, you know, if your eye wants to be, you know, separated from it, one eye wants to be out, you have to work to keep it straight. Let's say you're putting 10 pounds of effort to keep it straight. Well, you get tired. You get tired by the end of the day and that 10 pounds becomes too much and then you'll let your eye go. What the surgery does is makes that a 1 pound weight or takes some of that effort off of your eye and your brain. But still, you know, when you get really tired or that sort of, it might drift. You know, I never tell folks they'll never need a second surgery because at the age of 2 or 3, who knows? I mean, you got 90 years ahead of you. I mean, so how do we know if it's going to last forever? But oftentimes one surgery is all that is needed. But when it happens really early, so you said 2 to 3 years old, so that's a pretty early onset. They tend to be a little harder and they do require more than one surgery. So if I'm operating on someone at that early of an age for an intermittent exotropia, I'm saying, you know, there's a good chance that you might need another one down the line, but that's okay. If we can control you for 10, 20 years and then do then tweak it later, then we're doing you a good service. And then you had a reoperation later on. And honestly, I hope you didn't have to struggle too much with that double vision and the eye alignment not being ideal. Oftentimes people will be told that nothing can be done or you're too old now to have it. And it's really sad because folks will deal with that for decades or their entire life, not knowing that insurance is covered and you could have something done for it. I have no idea exactly what they found. Scar tissue gets a bad rap, but you know, you don't heal without scarring. So there's always, if you go back on any surgery, there should be some scar tissue or some adhesions that you clean that up. You move the muscles as you need to. But muscles can be operated on multiple times. And so if the person who did the reoperation said, really, there's nothing else to do, I'd get a second opinion. I can count on one hand the number of times where I've said, well, there's really nothing we can do.
Jason, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Rod emailed us. For years, he's heard about and read about cases where the patient had a serious eye condition, sometimes leading to blindness. And the common complaint is that the eye professional didn't offer him any suggestion for resources to assist them going forward. And Rod wanted to mention the state of Wisconsin offers free services to help people cope with vision loss through the Office for the Blind and Visually Impaired. And wonders why some eye professionals don't offer possible resources. What can we done to educate eye professionals about the services?
I'm really glad he brought that up. We are very blessed here in the state of Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired, Combat Blindness. We have wonderful low vision clinics that do amazing things for folks. And so we all want the new gee whiz therapy coming down the pike, but in the meantime, we want to optimize people's activities of daily living and make sure that they're making the best use of the vision that they have. And the technology that's being developed, within the Eye Institute. So a lot of what we do is not developing drugs, but developing new AIs or computer vision or, you know, things like that can help folks live more independently with vision loss right now and not have to wait for some fancy surgery that also has risks to it. So I know at the University of Wisconsin in our Department of Ophthalmology, we've got a lot of resources. Sunbrita Mundal is one of our optometrists who does low vision. She's fantastic and really sits down with patients, talks about what technology is available for them in the context of what they do. So it's different. Yeah. It's different from a farmer in a rural area of Wisconsin sure. than it is an accountant that lives downtown. So you really have to sit down, spend the time with folks, allow them to use the different technologies, choose what might be best for them, try it out. If it doesn't work, don't sink $20,000 into something if you're not going to use it.
Yeah.
And the services are available here. And he's right that a lot of folks and a lot of eye care professionals, you know, if there's not something I can offer you, then, you know, see you later. And they don't they don't do the next step, which is, but there is something out there for you. And they're wonderful people and they care about you and they have great technology.
Yeah, I've had folks on from the Office for the Blind and Visually Impaired on the show.
Oh,
great work.
Some of the best people I know.
Yeah, absolutely. Rod, thank you very much for that comment. Dot in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you. Hi, Dot.
Hi. I had cataract operation about a year and a half ago on both of my eyes, and I'm sorry to say, but it didn't do me much justice. And I'm wondering how it can be corrected. Should I still be taking Tiantrin or anything like that?
Yeah. So, again, that always goes back to why it didn't work. So cataract surgery is the most common surgery done in the United States. And so, but it's still surgery. And so even if you're 99% successful, that means there's 1% of folks that undergo it that are going to have an untoward effect. And as often as this surgery is performed, that's still a sizable number of people. A cataract surgery having not the outcome that you were hoping for can be for a number of different reasons, though. One could be that the surgery itself was complicated, which leading to other issues. Or it could be that you have more than one issue going on, so that you you had cataracts, and you did, but maybe you also had a macular pucker underneath that, or you had macular degeneration or glaucoma. And so, you know, you clear the window, the cataract is removed, which is, you know, supposed to be a clear tissue in the center of your eye that helps focus things. So that works, but now you're left with the film in the camera still having a problem, or the optic nerve having a problem. And our expectation is that we'll just get that cataract surgery is going to be what's going to cure everything. But if you have more than one thing going on, it may only incrementally help you, or maybe not even help you at all. We're pretty good at being able to assess folks and prepare them if we don't think they're going to have a great effect, or just say, hey, you know, let's just give it a try. So again, it depends a little bit on what happened with the surgery. If it was an uncomplicated surgery, but you're just not seeing as well as you'd like, then it might require you know just digging into that a little more deeper, being referred to a retina specialist or.
Yeah, I had my own issues with cataract surgery, and I wound up having a cornea transplant.
Yeah. And so that would be a complication of the surgery. And complications, again, happen. The absolute best surgeons in the world, in anything, will have complications. It just happens. It's all a matter of statistics. So what matters is that you get a good, caring practitioner. In an environment where they know how to handle those things when they occur, and they treat you with respect and listen to you along the way.
And I had that surgery many years back now, and I've had no problems since then.
Yeah.
That may be something for Dot, but maybe not. Maybe it's some, as you say, could be something totally different.
Yeah, but in your case, you had the complication and you had to have another surgery, but that one worked well. So again,
yeah.
So hopefully there's something like that for this caller too.
Thank you, Dot. Good luck. Appreciate the call. John in Park Falls, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. A great show. Here's my question. I have wet in one eye, and I'm currently taking injections. I have dry in the other eye. But what I've noticed recently, in the bright sunlight, it seems like, especially after being out a while and walking into the building, I seem to, like, go blind. I just can't adjust. Is that something to do with the macular degeneration?
Most likely, yes, and it's kind of a fascinating thing. You know, we have two types of photoreceptors in our eyes. We have cones and we have rods. And cones are what we use to see color and fine acuity, like when we read things. And it's also what we use almost exclusively in normal lighting or bright light situations. As the light gets dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, we use more of our rods. And our rods can't read a newspaper, but they're good for maneuvering in the dark and in low light situations. And so the macula is populated with cones for the most part. It has rods as well, too, but it has cones. So as those are lost, which is what happens in macular degeneration, you become more reliant on, from a ratio standpoint, on rods versus cones. So that when you're out in bright light, those rods, which saturate and aren't good in bright light, they just kind of cower and wait for the sun to go down. You're relying more on those. And so in those bright light situations, you a lot of folks will have the types of things that you're commenting on there too. And, you know, what do you do about it? Find a pair of sunglasses that helps you. Be careful when you go in from a bright to a dark situation so you don't bump into anything, fall down the stairs. Just exercise caution.
I was, John, I can relate a little bit to you because I've had that situation and coming into a building and then there's somebody there that says, oh, hi, Larry. And and they're a distance away. And for a few seconds, it takes a little time for the eyes to adjust.
Yeah. It does happen to all of us. I mean, that is a phenomenon we all know. Yeah. Like in a bright, sunny day, when you walk into a dark place, it takes you a while to adjust. It just more so when you start having macular problems.
John, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. David Gamm, our guest today, directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute at the UW-Madison. Questions for him? Give a call at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at your eye health today with our guest, Dr. David Gamm, directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Ophthalmology and Visual Science. So it's great to have him with us. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. And we've had some emails here. We should get to those. Mary and Rhinelander emailed us, 68 years old. The last few months, she's had floaters in her right eye, which has turned into what she would describe as if she's looking through a foggy line in part of the eye. She's now noticing floaters in her left eye as well. Anything that can be done for this, or is this just a part of aging?
Well, first of all, you do want to get that checked out. So, you know, the classic signs of retinal tears or detachments are what we call flashes and floaters. And the reason for that is that that jelly that's inside of the eye, if it pulls forward and it's attached to the retina as well. And it can pop a hole in the retina or create a bit of a tear. And when that happens, it releases proteins or even blood if you're breaking a bridging vessel. And the tugging portion of it causes the flashes of lights. It's a mechanical way of stimulating the photoreceptors. Now, most of the time, that's not a retinal tear or detachment. It's just the tugging and the vitreous pulling forward. But you don't know, and it's one of those things. It doesn't hurt. There's no pain involved. And so if you have new-onset floaters, especially if you have a lot of new ones, being associated with those flashes of light, which are like fireworks, you should get that checked out just to make sure that you're not dealing with anything that's a little more serious. Now, what to do about the floaters? Really nothing. You know, there are procedures that can be done. If you've got a really giant one that's right in the center, those carry risks to them. They're not always recommended. And so sometimes it's an annoyance. Most folks don't notice them unless they're looking at a pastel colored wall or a blue sky. So once again, getting it checked out, and then once you're there and having your retina looked at to make sure that nothing more serious is happening, you can ask them what's available and what the risk-benefit ratio is of any possible intervention.
Josh emailed. He was diagnosed with iritis in his right eye in his late 20s. A few years ago, he had cataract surgery in that same eye. Since then, Josh says he's noticed that he's got a floater and his vision is a little foggy.
Okay. Probably, a couple of different possibly different things, kind of apples and oranges. So the iritis is itis is inflammation. So it's kind of a generic term for inflammation in the front part of the eye. The ira comes from iris, but it's not necessarily the iris that's inflamed. It could be anything. But commonly we'll call that iritis. Most of the time, especially if it's just in one eye, it's what we call idiopathic, which means we're idiots. We don't know what causes it. We treat the symptoms. It goes away. It can be the a harbinger of an underlying systemic disease or autoimmune disorder sometimes, but in the vast majority of the case, it's not. And it sounds like it didn't rear its ugly head again, and then you had this cataract surgery. And then after that, I mean, sometimes surgery on the eye can kick up inflammation, and that can cause foggy vision and things like you're describing. So it is possible that that's the case. My guess would be that the cataract surgeon would be able to take a look. It's one of these things that's really easy to diagnose. We just have to look at your eye. We put you in that slit lamp, that microscope that we use, and we just look. And do we see floating around in the front part of the eye inflammatory cells, or do we see things that look foggy? And that's, those are indicative of inflammation. But it may not be inflammation at all. It could be something else that could be causing foggy vision. So, you know, a full ophthalmologic examination just to make sure we know what's going on is important.
Dave in Chippewa Falls, actually, he called but couldn't stay with us. He's wondering if there are any new studies in ischemic optic neuropathy. Do we know what causes it? Are there any new treatments or cures available?
Yeah, so ischemic optic neuropathy is basically a disruption of the blood flow. So the eye needs blood like every other part of our body, and the optic nerve, which is the cable that connects the retina to the brain, also needs a blood supply. And so if the blood vessels get clogged for any reason, you essentially get what's called a stroke. You know, a stroke in the eye is like a stroke in the brain, but it affects your vision and not other parts of your mentation. So right now, you know, if you catch it super early, and that's often hard to do, just like a stroke in the brain, sometimes you can reverse it or it will go away on its own. It'll, you know, whatever the clog is will dissipate and your blood flow will be restored. But if that doesn't happen, then everything that's downstream of that blood vessel that's fed by that blood will undergo degeneration. And so now we're into the same spot we talked about earlier in the show, where in any sort of degenerative disease, that's the area where we really lack good therapeutics right now. So what's being looked at, in addition to what are, you know, better ways to just treat stroke in general.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what medications get, you know, diagnosing it earlier, getting you in, getting treatment faster so that the degeneration never happens in the first place. But if you can't do that and it does happen, then we're looking at, you know, what are ways that we might be able to optimize the use of your remaining vision. How might we be able to replace the cells that have degenerated? And that's kind of where we get into stem cell therapies. That's not ready for prime time right now. There's a lot of snake oil right now that where people will say, yeah, if you pay us a certain amount of money, we'll do this treatment for you or use hyperbaric oxygen or something like that. And really, they're just you know, taking your money and not offering you any sort of treatment or maybe even putting you in harm's way. But there is a lot of legitimate research in this area. We're currently involved with a large group. It's a nationwide group of different universities from Hopkins to here at UW-Madison and the Eye Institute, Colorado, USC. And it's funded by a federal group called ARPA-H, which is kind of an offshoot of DARPA. And it's designed to really look at some of these devastating optic nerve disorders and can we offer a potential treatment for folks in the future. So a lot of research is going into it, but it's a tough one. You know, there's a spectrum of issues that from easier to harder to try to fix. And this is a tough one. The optic nerve contains 1.2 million tiny little wires that connect your retina to your brain. And, you know, being able to reconnect them or restore them is not a simple task.
Joe from Wausau called, couldn't stay with us. He's wondering if scar tissue from a detached retina surgery will cause complications in a glaucoma surgery.
It shouldn't, because it's in the different part of the eye. So for a detached retina, that's the back part of the eye. So if you think, you know, if you think of the eyeball as a globe, which it is, a hollow globe, the retina lines the back portion of it. Glaucoma surgery is on the front part of the eye. So while the eye is not a huge organ, To an ophthalmologist, you know, that's East Coast, West Coast. Mm-hmm. So they're separated by a good amount of distance. The scar tissue that you're probably talking about is something we call PVR, or proliferative vitreal retinopathy, which can occur and make reattaching retinas more difficult. But the surgical techniques for that are actually improved as well.
I'm wondering about, I don't think we've talked about healing optic nerve damage. Have we talked?
Well, ischemic optic neuropathy that our previous caller talked about is a type of that. So again, there's many different, you know, we use a generic catch-all term, but then if you, you know, lumpers and splitters, you know, there's actually, you know, dozens if not 100 different types of these things. So optic nerve damage can be from blood flow problems. It can be from glaucoma. It can be from any number of different conditions. But ultimately, they all kind of coalesce to the same endpoint, which is this deterioration or degeneration of the cells that make up that optic nerve. And so while the path might be different for different folks, the destination tends to be pretty close to being the same. And so a lot of the focus in the McPherson Eye Research Institute and around the world is, you know, what can we do for those folks that have kind of all arrived in the same the same location, which isn't actually a place you want to be.
Yeah. Jan was wondering, what are some of the common concerns when it comes to children's vision and eye health?
Oh, great question. Near and dear to my heart as a pediatric ophthalmologist. So, you know, the common things are still what we see the most and can still cause the most long-term issues. So a condition called amblyopia, which is more commonly called lazy eye, although lazy eye is sometimes also, you know, if you have a deviating eye or an eye that wanders, sometimes, you know, people use the lazy eye for that as well. But amblyopia is a condition where, for whatever reason, either because the eye isn't aligned correctly as a child, or the prescription in one eye is much different than the other, or the child was born with some sort of condition that affected the vision of one eye compared to the other. But what it does is it degrades the vision in one eye relative to another one. And we learn to see like we learn to walk and we learn to talk when we're little. So just like folks who are deaf, if they don't get hearing aids early, their speech doesn't develop quite normally. And so even if they get them when they're 7, 8, or 9, the speech isn't always there because you kind of miss that window where your brain is looking around going, okay, here, what am I gonna spend my real estate on? And so if an eye does not see well, then the brain will say, well, you know what? I don't want to spend a big chunk of myself paying attention to this eye that doesn't give me good information. And so it will be commandeered for other things. So there's actually physical changes in the brain that you can see. Now, that can be reversed. So if you identify that one eye is not seeing as well as the other one and fix that with sometimes just a pair of glasses, sometimes patching, sometimes drops, things like that, and then you restore a good visual image from that eye, the brain is plastic enough at an early age to fix that. And then you have a lifetime of good vision in that eye. If you miss that window, then it can't be reversed, or it can't be reversed very, very efficiently. And that could be a permanent situation where you have vision loss your entire life.
Some cool things on your website, by the way, the McPherson Eye Research Institute.
Yeah, no, we've got a it's vision.wisc.edu, so WISC for Wisconsin, vision.wisc.edu, and we do a pretty good job. Dr. Lang is our center administrator, and Gail Sturr and Michael Heim. We've got a wonderful small staff that punches well above our weight, and we maintain a really good website. We try to make it very informative for our members, so there are things on there for our scientists and our researchers, but also a lot of things there for the public to know what we're doing. It's part of what we're trying to do. It's not just doing things in an ivory tower. We want to communicate to the people of Wisconsin what it is we're doing and to help you.
And you're doing a great job of that, David. Dr. David Gamm directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute at the UW-Madison. It's great to have him with us. He's also a professor in the Department of Ophthalmology and Visual Sciences. It's great to have him, and I'm sure he'll come back and be with us again. Thank you so much, Dr. Gamm.
You're very welcome.
Coming up, we're going to take a look at organ donation. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thank you so much for joining us today here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're spending the next hour talking about organ donation, covering the process, working through your questions, hearing your donation stories, and I hope you'll join in as we visit with a trio of guests. Dr. Ty Dunn is Surgical Director of the Kidney and Pancreas Transplant Programs at Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Ty Dunn, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
With us as well, Deb Ness is a kidney donor. Deb, thank you for joining in.
I'm super excited to be here. Thanks.
Thank you so much. And Jeff Call, a recipient of Deb's kidney donation. Jeff Call, thank you for joining us.
Well, good afternoon, Larry. Nice to hear your voice.
As we talk with these three, I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Have you recently donated an organ, or have you received a transplanted organ from a donor? What was the experience like for you? Is a loved one scheduled for an organ transplant soon, maybe? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Dunn, let's turn to you first. What kind of need is there for organ donors in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, there's a huge need, honestly. As far as kidney donors in Wisconsin, we have a lot of people on the list nationally, just a little bit less than 90,000. And, you know, here in Wisconsin, there's 556 people today on the kidney transplant list in Wisconsin. So that's a lot of people.
Yeah, it is indeed. Any difference in terms of nationalities?
Well, I think the demographics kind of parallel the population demographics of the different parts of the country. So, you know, in some parts of the country, there's a lot of density in the population, and so there's longer waiting times. For example, in New York and California, people can be waiting up to 8 to 10 years on dialysis for a kidney. And so here in Wisconsin, we are lucky that it's not as much of a waiting time, but it still, for some blood types, can be up to 6 years.
Well, I know from experience that organ and tissue donations occur after the donor has died. In my case, I have a cornea transplant from a woman who died, and I have some bone marrow from a man who passed away just relating to a tumor that I had in my finger. So that is common, but I want to talk more about the living donations, Dr. Dunn. Which organs can be donated while you're alive?
Yeah, so kidney is the most common by far. There were about 7,000 living kidney donors in the nation last year, helping out their fellow man, which is great. It is possible to give part of your liver, either the right lobe to an adult or the left lobe to a baby. And in very rare cases, not really commonly done anymore, there have been living lung donor transplants.
Boy, that would be a difficult one, I would think.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff and Deb, I want to talk to you before we go to the phones and we hear from Samantha and Blair and Juanita in Annawa. I want to talk to you for just a minute or two. How did you come to know each other? Jeff, maybe you can chime in.
Yeah, well, we started knowing each other when our two daughters were playing soccer, and they both played in the Milwaukee area, and they were about 12 years old. And so I've known Deb and her husband, Tim, since my daughter was 12. And so that's 20 years. Both Amy, which is Deb's daughter, and my daughter, Hannah, are 32, roughly about that. So we've known each other for 20 years, and they also played, besides club soccer, then they went to the same college and played at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. So we took a lot of road trips together. So we know each other pretty well.
Oh, man. And Deb, you're the A-Kidney donor here. Tell us more about how you decided to donate your kidney to your longtime friend, Jeff.
Well, as Jeff shared, you know, we've been friends for a long time. We've traveled together quite a bit throughout the whole U.S., going to a lot of soccer tournaments. And I always knew that Jeff had an issue with his kidneys, with a kidney disease that he can speak to a little bit further. And one day we were up in Minocqua and hanging out and, you know, sitting out on the deck. And Jeff mentioned that, you know, Deb, I'm on the transplant list now. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like I didn't realize it really was going to come down to that. And we're sitting out there, Jeff and his wife, Katie, and my husband, Tim, and I, and we're just talking. And I looked at Jeff and I said, well, Jeff, you can have my kidney. And my husband looks at me and he's like, Deb, don't you think you need to talk to me about that? And I'm not quite the independent, opinionated woman. And I looked at him, I said, no, I don't need to. So that kind of started the process there. And, you know, my husband and I used to live in Wisconsin, and we moved to Colorado in 2019. And now we live in the Front Range of Denver. So we always go back to Wisconsin every year, and we always spend a bunch of time, a full week with Jeff and Katie and some friends, and we enjoy each other's company. So that kind of started the journey for us at that point.
Oh, man. And Jeff, when did you know that you needed a kidney transplant? Had you not told Deb about that when you first learned of it?
Well, I actually found out that I had polycystic kidneys when I was the age of about 35. My cousin had found out that he had an ultrasound and found out that he had it. And both my mom and her two sisters had polycystic kidneys. So he got an ultrasound and found out he had it. So I, about the age of 35, I had an ultrasound and found out that, yes, I had it also. So it took about, oh, I'd say a good 15 years before I actually had to start changing my diet a little bit. And then, so I didn't really tell a lot of people that I had all that because it didn't really affect me that much. But then the last 5 to 6 years, then I had to change my diet quite a bit. And then I started just telling people that there's asked me why I'm not eating this food or not eating that food. And I had to tell them that that's my new diet now because of this disease. So that's how it kind of went.
Well, just waiting for Jeff, I imagine waiting for a donation was, I don't know, painful in some ways?
Well, you know, I was actually really lucky because I had just got on the transplant list, and Deb was just there that week up in Minocqua that weekend, and we asked about our blood type, and we matched, and things just kind of took off from there. So I didn't really have to, like, I didn't even think about much of a transplant until we started talking, and then the ball started rolling. Deb's very good at getting the ball rolling, and she's very persistent. And, yeah, so from there on in, I didn't really have that much issue. I was, you know, just wondering if we matched well enough so that we could actually be a partner, recipient and a donor. But, yeah, it went pretty quickly.
That is really great. It probably does. I'm sure it doesn't always work that way.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, and Dr. Dunn, you probably have some experience on the length of time that people sometimes wait.
Yeah, it really depends upon their blood type, and most importantly, whether they have a potential living donor volunteer. That's what I would call people like Deb, right? A living donor volunteer. Only about 1 out of 4 people that step forward are actually found to be healthy enough to be able to donate a kidney. So, you know, that's a process. The donors are really highly evaluated to make sure that their health is sufficient, that they have extra kidney function, that they can afford to give away one kidney. We know that people live for a very long time with one kidney. And so it's not really a long-term health issue, but it's making sure that there's not any kind of, you know, hidden cancers or infections that could be transmitted.
Yeah. Deb, go ahead.
So it was a very thorough testing process. And I would say that Frater and the transplant team there did such a good job to help me understand the process, help me understand the need for the testing. And sometimes some of the tests that I had set up, like we had a full day of testing that was scheduled in March of 2023. And I had to meet with the transplant team, the nephrologist, the social worker, a dietitian. And I'm like, why am I meeting with all these people? And they want to make sure that you are healthy enough. They want to make sure that mentally and psychologically you can handle this, and that you're going to be okay with it, and that your family and your loved ones are okay with it. So they had to, you know, get comfortable with all that. And then there was all the testing that had to be done, EKGs and chest x-rays and CT scans and nuclear medicine, GFR studies and stress tests and blood work and urine tests. And it went on and on. And, you know, at the end of the day, I came back, I don't know, two or three times in 2023 for testing at Frater, because I always wanted to be back and do as much of it as I could in at Frater versus being in Colorado. And I know more about my health now than I ever thought I would. And as Dr. Dunn shared, you know, being healthy enough to give away one of your kidneys, because your function goes from 100% of whatever my normal function is to being cut in half. And then over the next 3 or 4 months, my one kidney I have left starts growing and being able to have more output. So the process and working with the folks at Frater was just an absolute wonderful experience for me.
Oh, thank you so much for that comment. I want to give some of our listeners a chance to join in. And Samantha in Blair, thank you for waiting. What's your comment?
Thank you. There was a guy at my church that was on dialysis for, I don't know, about 10 years, and he had no kidney functions. They took out his kidneys. He was just a mess. And then he had gotten a kidney, and after a while that rejected. So then he was at home with his wife, and they got the phone call at midnight to be down in Madison. They had a kidney for him if he wanted it. So they went down there, and he had the transplant. And he said it was from someone that was like an actual live donor that was like 18, 19, 20, somewhere in there. Didn't drink, didn't smoke, no drugs. He said, you know, this is like a brand new car I got in here, because it barely had, you know, he said it barely had a light.
Oh, man, an 18 or 19-year-old. Oh, Dr. Dunn, comment on that?
Yeah, what a blessing for your friend. I have to say, though, if he's getting called at midnight, it's not to set up a living donor surgery. This is probably a person that had some sort of, you know, traumatic brain injury or something that had become brain dead. And so the process is that they go to surgery, like a planned surgery after they're declared brain dead, and then they go through a surgery to procure the organs. And so these are technically deceased donor organs, but obviously a very good quality and really one of the best kidneys you could probably get. So outside of living donors, obviously.
Yeah. And Juanita has something for us that certainly relates to this. Juanita, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for having me. Our daughter, when she was 16 and got her driver's license, chose to be an organ donor. She felt that it was a very important thing to be able to donate your organs. When she was 21, she died in a car accident. And her organs were donated, and various parts have helped multitudes of people. We've received letters when things first happened. They used heart valves, they used bone marrow and bones, skin grafts for grafts. They, when she first passed, over 75 people actually parts of her daughter. 75 people. I think that out of that, 4 people received portions from what they took of her heart. And they also had preserved what they could for skin grafts and bone marrow.
Well, Juanita, I am very sorry for your loss, but if there's anything that can help a loss like that is to know how much your daughter has contributed to the lives of so many people. Thank you so much. Dr. Ty Dunn, maybe a comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you on behalf of all of the families and people, like families of people that are waiting for this precious gift. You know, it's donor families are so incredibly special, and I've been lucky enough in my life to meet with many, you know, throughout their journey. And, you know, it's just the, you know, a small chance to make something good come of something that's such a tragedy. And so I think a lot of people think that maybe they're too old to donate their organs after they die, or that they've got problems. And I think people don't really understand the power of tissue donation, which is what I hear so much about from our donor mom. You know, eyes, heart valves, you know, tendons, all sorts of things, in addition to the organs, obviously, that are often very healthy in a younger person. So even older people that may have other problems can still donate tissue and things that are quite meaningful for people. So thank you very much for sharing your story.
Juanita, thank you so much. Appreciate your call very much. Well, we are talking about organ donation today on the show, The Gift of Life. We've got Jeff and Deb. Deb Ness was a kidney donor, and she donated a kidney to Jeff Call. Was a recipient of Deb's kidney transplant. I'm going to talk with them some more about their experiences. And Dr. Ty Dunn, who is surgery director of the kidney and pancreas transplant programs at Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thank you so much for being with us today as we talk the gift of life, how organ donations save lives, with our two guests, Dr. Ty Dunn, surgical director of the kidney and pancreas transplant program at Frederick Hospital in the Medical College of Wisconsin, and Deb Ness, a kidney donor, and Jeff Call is the recipient of Deb's kidney transplant. Lots of callers online with many comments. Joanne Rhinelander is up now. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, I just wanted to pitch the idea of being a donor. I donated a kidney I'm 75, and donated a kidney about, I think, 10 years ago, non-directed. And then my wife, it worked out real well. And so my wife donated a kidney in 2021. And again, it worked out very well for her.
Well, Joe, thank you. Thank you for calling, and thank you for that, for what you and your wife did. Dr. Ty Dunn, maybe a comment?
Yeah, wow, that's an amazing thing. You guys are two special people donating altruistically. What he's talking about for the listeners is non-directed means that he wants to donate a kidney to help anyone who's in need, and he doesn't have anyone in mind. And that's where the transplant centers can work within their own center or with the National Kidney Registry to identify a recipient of his gift. And so sometimes that actually spins off a chain of transplants, because maybe the person he's going to donate to has a donor, but they're not compatible. And then that donor can donate, kind of like a chain of dominoes.
That was great, Joe. Thank you so much for what you've done and for calling. Lois in Chippewa Falls, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Lois.
Hi there. I donated, my husband and I signed papers about 15 years ago to donate our bodies. And when my husband passed away in January, we contacted UWM, and they said they didn't need him, that they had, he was too tall, and like they had too many bodies or something. So I was just kind of shocked.
Hmm. Does that happen often, Dr. Dunn?
Yeah, I'm not sure if she's talking about donating his body to science or for actual organ donation. So I don't know a lot about the former.
Yeah. Lois, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. We had another caller who whose son was born with one kidney and wondering how if that is very prevalent and how, can he expect a long life?
Oh, we know that people can live just fine with one kidney. I think what we need to put in the context of is any other health conditions that might slowly cause some strain on that kidney. So sometimes people are born with other abnormalities that can kind of put more strain on that kidney. And sometimes people do end up needing a kidney transplant because of some of these congenital anomalies. But there's a lot of people that live just a perfectly normal life and a normal lifespan with one kidney that may be found incidentally. And we have a lot of data from, the different world wars over time where people have lost a kidney traumatically and they've lived for a long time. We have a living donor registry in the University of Minnesota with over 40 years of follow-up on living donors. And there's a Dutch registry as well with about that much follow-up. So that's what we know about living with one kidney.
All right. So that's optimistic and pretty good news. I want to go back to you, Jeff, and thinking about the folks who have called in who have donated or are planning to. How did Deb's decision to give you one of her kidneys affect your life?
Well, it was a huge decision on Deb's part. I mean, that takes not only a lot of time, but also a lot of she was an amazing person, actually. And the whole experience for me has been, life-saving. I was getting pretty close towards the end here of having to go on dialysis, my goal was not to go on dialysis. And I was very close to having to go on, and then Deb stepped in there. And the thing about Deb is she had to fly back and forth from Colorado to Milwaukee. I think she did at least four times. And we had a little setback in January. We were supposed to have the transplant and about 20 hours. So she was in Milwaukee ready to go. And 20 hours before the surgeries happened, I had an incident where I think one of my cysts on my kidneys broke open. So I was urinating blood. So they had to cancel the entire transplant. And so we had to wait, I think it was almost 3 weeks to a month. So Deb had to come back again, and that's when we did it in February. But so she's been like a godsend to me, yes.
Oh, wow. Deb, I'm wondering you're obviously a pretty strong-willed person, but how did the family, your husband and so forth, I'm sure there was some initial what, but how was that like, the relationship there within your own family?
Well, it was a little bit challenging with my three adult children. My husband is great. He's super supportive of everything. He's concerned, if I'm going to go under and have some major surgery, he's concerned about risk. With every surgery, there is some risk. You can't ever take that out. There is always some. So he was a little bit concerned about that. With my three adult children, they're all very supportive, but one of them voiced a little bit more concern about, are you sure you want to do this? Like, what if something happens? And we just kind of talked it through, and I would share with them my discussions with the different staff at Freightert. And the thing for them was they knew Jeff and Katie and Hannah and the family very well too, because our families have been together for a long time. So we just kind of had to work through those points and times where they questioned it, but everybody became supportive and everybody was on board. I do want to mention a couple other things. And Juanita mentioned this about her daughter at 16 deciding that she wanted to donate, and then she passed away, just a few years later and donated. My entire life, adult life, I always had everything marked on my driver's license to donate my organs, but I never took the step to say, should I be a living donor? Never kind of went there. And until Jeff became part of my life and became needing the kidney, it never really took my mind to that point. And after that happened, it's kind of like your awareness changes. And as you know, I live in Colorado, and I was driving one day, and I was behind a car. And this car was driving up into the front range, and on the back window of the car was, "Someone I know needs a kidney. Can you help? Please call," and a phone number. And it, you know, wow. It's again the awareness, because you're realizing that I'm going through this myself. And here's a random person who obviously has somebody very dear to them that needs a kidney. And there's just not enough kidneys, living donor kidneys out there available to help people. And it was just shocking that to what extent people will go to try to get help for somebody that they love. And, you know, similar to the caller that we had who said that he and his wife both donated, when I donated, which was just in February of this year, it happened to be on National Donor Day, Valentine's Day, and my 63rd birthday. So I was 63 when I donated, and I'm fine, and the recovery has been fine. And so if you've ever even thought about it, whether it's for somebody that you know, somebody that you don't know, because as Dr. Dunn talked about, you can help so many people, and it's really not a difficult thing to do, and you can recover so very well.
Someone else wondered if people with a targeted donor, do they kind of move to the front of the line, so to speak, Dr. Dunn?
I think it's important to understand that there's kind of two different things we're talking about here. So when people are on the national waiting list, you know, they would pretty much gain access to deceased donor kidneys. And most of that access is honestly driven by time waiting, which is, you know, there's, like I said, almost 90,000 people waiting and only 27,000 transplants done last year in the whole nation. There's over 1,200 people just in Wisconsin waiting for kidneys. But we only did 550 kidney transplants in the state of Wisconsin last year. So, you know, this is where that gap in unmet need is. Now, if a living donor becomes an option for you, then you don't have to worry about waiting on the waiting list. You just get the transplant, you know. And that frees up a kidney for another person that doesn't have a donor. So, you know, a living donor option is really the way to get the most healthy kidney possible, and the way to not get sicker while you're waiting. So you can just avoid all of that time, either on dialysis or waiting for the kidney.
Jared in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance now. Jared, thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks, Larry. About 7 or 8 years ago, my wife donated a kidney to a coworker, but she has rheumatoid arthritis. And from what we understand, with her having the rheumatoid arthritis with only one kidney, she can't really be treated for rheumatoid arthritis. And it's really starting to affect her now, and she's only 47.
Oh, Jared, thanks for calling. Dr. Dunn, comment.
Some treatments for rheumatoid arthritis are simply targeting pain. So a very common pain reliever is in that category of like ibuprofen or Advil or Naprosyn. And so we do counsel people not to take a lot of that medication when they've donated a kidney, because that medication can harm kidney function. And so that would be one form of treatment that she's not a candidate for. But there are other forms of treatment for rheumatoid arthritis that maybe she can talk with her doctors about.
Yeah, other than the ones you mentioned. Jared, thank you very much for calling. Joan in Hobart, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I just wondered, I'm 82 and in really good health, except I have joint replacements, and I wondered if there is an age limit, a top age limit for certain
kinds
of.
Yeah. There an age limit for certain kinds of donations? Joan's wondering.
Yeah, they're a great question, Joan. So we don't really have any upper age limit for donation. It really depends upon how healthy the person is and how fit they would be for, you know, the operation and the recovery.
And for recipients, likewise, we actually don't have an upper age limit here at Frater, but you can imagine that, you know, the older patients really need to be pretty fit to be safe to move forward with a transplant. But we have been transplanting people up into their 70s. Yeah.
So, Joan, I guess it's worth, what would Joan do to determine whether or not she'd be acceptable for this?
Like with any person that's interested in finding out more about donation or if it's an option for them or just to learn about it to see if they want to move forward, they would contact the transplant center and speak with the living donor team. And the living donor team is dedicated to answering their questions and making sure that they're fully informed and to help screen them to see if it's something that is reasonable to move forward with or, you know, to undergo an evaluation for.
Do we know how many transplant teams exist in Wisconsin?
Well, there are four transplant centers. There's Children's of Wisconsin, which is a children's center exclusively. And then there's University of Wisconsin-Madison and Fratert and another local program here in Milwaukee.
So four opportunities that I would expect. So if you were going to Fratert, you're interested in maybe because of location and so forth. You're on, how do you get to those folks? Online is probably the easiest.
Yep, online is great. We have a QR code online and people can explore some frequently asked questions about donation and there's a phone number to call and speak with a donor expert about all of their questions and then they could do some initial questionnaire type screening and then go from there.
Let's go, Joan, thanks again. Anna in Wausau, we'll go to you. Hi, Anna, thank you for calling.
Hi, yeah, I just wanted to call in because I think this is a great program and I am I'm a recipient of a living donor kidney transplant and the start of my kidney disease was I got it at the age of 4 as a child, and I'm now closer to 50, and a close friend of mine was not a match for me, but through the UW-Madison program, she was a match for someone else, and it became a chain of 6 donors and 6 recipients, and it's just the best kidney transplant I've ever had, and it's so special that we can do these chains and that there's people willing to do living donor donation.
Oh, Anna, thank you so much for calling. This interesting, this the chain, that reaction that kind of takes place under something like this, Dr. Dunn.
Yeah, it's a really special opportunity. You know, it's estimated about a third of the people on the national waiting list have had people step forward, but in the past they just were not the right blood type. And now we don't even really have to worry about that because if they're medically suitable and they want to move forward after their evaluation, they're approved for donation, we just figure out if we can donate directly. And if not, then we utilize the partnership that we have with the National Kidney Registry, which is a national program that ties together all of the transplant centers, all the major transplant centers in the nation who participate. And so at any one time, there's generally several hundred people in that pool. And that's where we can find the match for the intended recipient, and then we can schedule a living donor transplant. We simply move the kidneys to where the recipients are, so donors don't have to travel and be outside of their support network. It's really a great option.
Anna, thank you. I'm sorry, go ahead, Deb.
I wanted to add, based on what Dr. Dunn said, that was an option for me, too. When I was here in Denver area, they said I could go to a transplant center here and have the surgery, and then they would transplant the kidney to Milwaukee, to Fratert, and Jeff would have his surgery. I made a personal decision for me that I wanted to be in Milwaukee at Fratert in an OR right down from Jeff so that there was nothing that was going to be in the way. But if you're considering donation and you live somewhere else, I mean, it doesn't matter. There's so many transplant centers available that can accommodate you wherever you live.
Mm-hmm. That's a really important point. Glad you brought that up. We call that remote donation. And so that would be a remote directed donation where, you know, the donor's just in a different hospital, but the kidney is transported to the directed recipient. you know, I think that the other opportunities that the Paired Exchange Program, and obviously, you know, compatible people can choose to participate, because you can imagine they can donate their one kidney and transplant one patient, or they could basically be the reason that multiple people get transplanted, as was described by the previous caller. So participating through the National Kidney Registry can provide some donor protections and some lost wage reimbursement in case people are concerned that, you know, financially it would be a hardship for them to donate to be off work while they recover. But also a lot of people would say, you know, well, I would donate, but I'm worried that maybe my child or my loved one might need a kidney someday. So people can donate altruistically through the National Kidney Registry and name up to five individuals that if any one of those five ever needs a kidney, they will get a living kidney transplant out of the registry.
Oh.
So it's a pretty amazing thing that really helps provide a lot of peace of mind for people that are wanting to go forward, but just really not sure it's the right thing for their family. So,
yeah, that is really good news. I didn't know that, and it certainly would ease a lot of people's minds. I'm pretty sure of that. Taking a look at transplanting with our transplants today, organ donations, I should say, with our three guests, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking organ donation today with Dr. Ty Dunn, Surgical Director of the Kidney and Pancreas Transplant Programs at Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin, and with Deb Ness, a kidney donor, and Jeff Call, who is a recipient of Deb's kidney transplant. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's take a question from Mike in Madison. Mike, thank you for calling.
Yeah, good afternoon. Some of my question has partially been answered just a few minutes ago, but your guests can go further in this. I'm calling because my friend, good friend, had wanted to donate a kidney to his father out of state. But by the time he got done doing all the tests, everything, this and that, he missed so much work that he lost his job. By the time he got a new job, got his finances back in order, and was ready again to donate, his father was no longer eligible for the kidney transplant. And so I'm wondering if there are any systems set up, and your guest had mentioned some financial aid. Are there systems set up to help people financially to be able to do that? For, you know, my friend was is a very low income person, but he really wanted to donate to save his dad's life. But just financially, to drive out of state and do all the tests and do all that, it was just incredibly financially burdensome. Are there things set up for to help people who would like to donate?
So that is a very sad story. I think it's important to understand how important it is to be as efficient as possible with the evaluation. We worked really hard at our center to try to make it like a one-day thing. It's actually not the whole day, but then the problem is, you know, if there's concerns that require additional testing, then that needs to kind of figure out how to get done. So some patients do have to go through some additional testing, and that can require additional trips to the medical center and whatnot. To speak to your question about assistance, the National Living Donor Assistance Center is a national program that provides some travel help and some financial assistance for people that are in the process of undergoing their living donor workup. So there is that. And as I mentioned, the lost wage reimbursement from the National Kidney Registry. It's up to $6,000 for the time taken off work. Most people with desk jobs are off work for about 3 weeks, but we always encourage patients to take, you know, to plan to take at least 6 weeks off just to give themselves some grace during their recovery time. So I don't know. I mean, I've met Deb and worked with Deb, and I have to tell you, a lot of donors are very motivated, kind of type A people. So I say that with a smile on my face.
That is for sure.
Encourage our donors to slow down and smell the roses while they recover, because it is a process. It does take some time.
Yeah. Don in Madison has something that may relate to this. Don, hi.
Hi. Yeah.
I was a living donor about a dozen years ago. My sister-in-law had kidney disease. Her sister, my wife, was not medically suited as a donor. And so I donated into a chain of three donors and three recipients. It was the coolest thing ever. My kidney went to San Diego. The woman in San Diego, her daughter donated a kidney to a woman in Baltimore. A friend of the woman in Baltimore donated a kidney to my sister-in-law. It was just crazy. But the one thing that I haven't heard mentioned yet is at the time that this donation happened, I was an employee of the state of Wisconsin. And there was a state law then, and I don't believe it's been repealed, that says that any state employee that becomes a living donor is entitled to 30 days of leave with pay, no interruption in seniority, no interruption in insurance, none of that sort of thing. After my donation, I was ready to go back to work after about 3 weeks or so. And my boss said, no, take the full 30 days, just in case something goes south.
Don, that's interesting news. And Dr. Dunn, are you familiar with this?
There are benefits. I'm not sure exactly of the benefit in the state of Wisconsin. I'm sad to say that I need to learn about that a little more because I'm relatively new to Wisconsin. But there are benefits also at some employers where they have joined the donor circle, and the employers actually will guarantee keeping your job and making sure that there's appropriate reimbursement there for going forward with the donation. So there's a lot of moves afoot to try to make sure that people are having disincentives removed, so you don't have to worry about your job, you don't have to worry about the finances. So we're trying to make it as easy as possible for people that want to move forward.
And this is Deb. Me, when I did my donation, I was retired, so I had the ability to travel back and forth, and it was very easy for me to do it. However, the employer that I retired from, had I still been employed there, just like Dr. Dunn said, they had a program that was in place for anybody that chose to be a living donor to help protect them with their employment, to give them the time off from work with pay. And it was not a state, entity. It was a large technology company. And there's many large companies throughout the United States that do offer that. It might be a little bit more challenging for those smaller ones, but there are a lot of employers that participate in that.
Excellent. And Don, thank you again. Marlene in New Hope, we go to you next. Hi, Marlene.
Hi. I was wondering, I've signed up since I was a teen on my driver's license or whenever I could, and now I hear that that's not adequate, that they're, I again checked whatever box, but I also know people like with bone marrow, there's a certain registry. How do people make sure they are registered at the various places that need registration? If I could stay on the line to listen, I just walked in from my car and can't get you on my house radio.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a great, it's a great point. I think it's important to know that making your intentions known by getting on the registry when you do your license, and there's an organization called Donate Life Wisconsin that you can sign up through just to really declare your intentions. But I think more so even than that is to make sure that your family is aware, because in the absence of any kind of written declaration of your intention, and your family may be asked, had you thought about donation? And if they know how you feel, they're more likely to be able to honor your wishes.
Yeah, it's a very, very good point. And Marlene, thank you so much for calling. Joe in Chippewa Falls emailed, after a long time on dialysis and on the waiting list, his wife was playing bingo in Chippewa Falls one evening when she got a call about a donor. She yelled out bingo in the crowded room and left for Madison.
Good for her.
Yeah, that's probably the best bingo she ever ever got. Well, it sounds to me like obviously there's no question in your mind about this.
That's right. I would never change anything. I've said this to Jeff so many times and to his family. There's nothing I would ever change. This was meant to be. In my heart, I say, why didn't I ever think about this before? Why didn't I do it sooner? But if I would have done it sooner, I wouldn't have been there when Jeff needed me. And so it all worked out the way it was meant to be. And if there's anybody that's thinking about it, it really isn't that difficult. And there's just so many people that have the need that you could potentially help. So give it some thought and reach out to the team and have the discussion and see if it's something you want to take that journey down.
Yeah, absolutely. Jeff, for you, you couldn't be happier.
That's an understatement, Larry. Yes. It was so nice that I got to meet Deb and all the things she's done for us. And I also wanted to say, my sister Kim donated a kidney to my aunt 30 years ago, and she's living great with one kidney. So it really is true that you can live with one kidney for a long time. And also, I just wanted to say thank you to Dr. Dunn for coming from Pennsylvania all the way to Wisconsin and being part of the Frater family there and helping Deb and I out. That was very nice of you.
I'm a Midwesterner, so this is where I belong.
Okay.
Oh my goodness me. Well, this has been really great. Just for more information, Dr. Dunn, maybe where do people go if they want to maybe become a donor?
I think it's important to partner with the transplant center that you wish to work with. And you can go to the website. I think that's the most direct way. So obviously, you know, we have a website. If you just Google, you know, Frater MCW kidney transplant, it's going to take you to there. And you can explore the resources that we have online. And you can respond online or via phone if you'd like to know more. And I'm sure all transplant centers have those same types of resources.
Yeah, I would definitely think that would be the case. Well, you know, I was just thinking about myself. You know, here I've got a cornea from someone who unfortunately passed away. And it was great for me. I was given a chance in this case to write a letter anonymously. I didn't know the family, and the family didn't know that the letter was coming from me, but it was great to be able to write a letter of thanks to that family. And I also had some bone marrow, I think I might have mentioned, from a man because of a tumor I had in my finger. And I was able to get some bone marrow from another person, and you know, sort of the same thing. It's a humbling experience, and certainly made me want to make sure that if I pass away, or possibly be a living donor, that I'm here to be able to do that. And I want to thank you all very much for taking time to be with us today. Dr. Ty Dunn, Surgical Director of the Kidney and Pancreas Transplant Programs at Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Deb Ness, kidney donor. Jeff Call, recipient of Deb's kidney transplant. It was great to have you all with us, and thank you all very much for being with us today. Just a quick look tomorrow, we'll learn about how some research that's being done on transmitters to track fish in the Great Lakes. And I mention our great team, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our producers, technical directors, Jeff Robbins and Lee Rayburn, executive director Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller.